How are you? I just decided I'd be here.
We're going.
Okay.
All right.
Good morning.
It's good to be back in front of you as your attorney, gentlemen.
I feel better, too.
Yeah.
I'm glad
to hear that. So I am here to discuss exempt and non-exempt employees under the Fair Labor Standards Act. We also had a comp time, flex time policy that was submitted as part of your packet. We're just going to table that for now. I think this is the more pressing item, and I wanted to discuss it with you gentlemen. So as you probably are aware, the U.S. Department of Labor requires that all employers categorize their employees as exempt or non-exempt under the Fair Labor Standards Act, which essentially makes them entitled to overtime if they're non-exempt, or not entitled to overtime if they're exempt. This kind of seems backwards, but that's what we're working with. So. I think it's just good employment practice because the employee knows if they're entitled to overtime or not, and the county will know for accounting purposes whether they have to pay overtime or not. Also with this, the ADP system that's going to be implemented soon, this is a requirement of that system that all employees are classified as either exempt or non-exempt under the Fair Labor Standards Act. So the purpose of me addressing you today was sort of just to broach the subject and to see how the commission wanted to deal with this designation process. My initial thinking was submit the question to all department heads and elected officials whether they feel like their employees are exempt or non-exempt, and then the commission makes the final decision in terms of that status. But by no means wedded to that position, and again, I just wanted to open the topic up for debate.
So just as a question, are there certain employees that are statutorily exempt, like elected officials, for example? We're not entitled to overtime, I don't believe.
No, but there has been some changes. I believe that I'd have to do some research on elected officials, but traditionally you have been non-exempt.
I'm sorry, exempt.
I'm confusing myself now. But I do believe there have been some changes that may entitle elected officials to overtime pay. So that's a complicating factor. But there are, yes, the U.S. Department of Labor issues guidance in terms of, it's not always black and white as we'd like it to be, but guidance in terms of whether these employees are entitled to overtime or not. So there is definitely statutory guidance out there to help us.
Any statutory guidance on part-time employees?
Yes, but I believe they are not entitled to, or they are entitled to overtime pay, yes. So even if you're seasonal or if you're part-time, you are entitled to overtime pay if you work more than 40 hours per week.
But if you're considered half-time or third-time, say you're hired on at 10 hours a week and you work for 15, are you entitled to overtime?
No, it's only when you exceed that 50 or that 40-hour threshold.
Only if you exceed
or more than 8 hours per day, then you're entitled.
So, Mr. Chairman, so Matt, this includes salaried individuals. So, if I'm salaried and I work, my salary is X, and that is based on 40 hours a week, 5 days. Five days a week on an 8 hour day. And so if I get, say I have to be wherever I am and it takes me 2 extra hours to get by, so those 2 hours are overtime even though I'm salaried?
In some cases, yes. Like deputy police officers, deputy sheriffs, they are salaried employees, but they are entitled to overtime pay. And so if they work more than 40 hours per week or more than 8 hours per day, they get that overtime pay even though they are salaried. But then there are salaried positions like mine that I am exempt. And so I do not receive overtime pay even though I would work, you know, if I work 50 hours a week. So it's, again, it's a little complicated. It's not as black and white as I'd like it to be. But yes, there are instances where salaried employees are definitely entitled to overtime pay.
So, Matt. Mr. Chairman, it's going to be hard for us as commissioners to figure out these designations because we don't know exactly what each employee's job description does. For example, the Sheriff's Department does. The only person that knows that is Casey, and he's deputy. So.
And so that my idea was have those supervisors.
The recommendations would come.
Yeah, would come from those department heads and elected officials, because I agree they know what those folks do day in and day out. But the ultimate decision, I think, probably should lie with the commission.
Sure. And at some point, though, that we may have a disagreement on one or two positions. Is that where we have the discussion with that department head to say, why'd you choose this path or what happened?
Yep.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And we would want you in on that discussion.
Sure. And I'm happy to assist all the supervisors in making those recommendations.
So in terms of understanding where we are now or why we are where we are, and the concept you're responsible for what you know, is this situation brought about because of a requirement from ADP? I guess what I'm asking is how come it hadn't been addressed in the past?
Yeah, good question.
I don't know if there's ever been a formal list of employees that were exempt or non-exempt. I can say that, yes, ADP is kind of the impetus behind this. But as I said earlier, I think it's just good employment practice.
Well, I understand that. Yeah, I'm just saying, but why now?
It's a fair question. I don't believe it's ever been done in the county.
Do we know where other counties are in this at all?
I don't.
I've never heard it discussed. I mean, among other commissioners, has ever been anything Wyoming commissioners have ever talked about.
Yeah.
Well, I imagine it's something that could come to light anytime somebody would file a complaint with the labor board.
Yep, exactly.
So we're just being proactive in that regard.
Yeah, I think it's...
And compliant.
Yes. I mean, so federal law requires that we designate the employees as exempt or non-exempt.
So, for example, say Carrie is county clerk. If she has to come in on a Saturday during, say, it's budget week, I don't know if Carrie's done this, but I know numerous times our former clerk was here on weekends catching up on work. Are they then entitled to overtime?
Not if they're exempt.
Yeah, and
are they exempt or non-exempt?
And like I said, I think there have been some changes, and I'd have to do some more research on elected officials. But traditionally, yes, they have not been entitled to overtime pay. They have been exempt employees.
And this is where we're going to make that determination.
So if there's changes in the law, I guess you'll research that and let us know.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, because we've never done it in the past.
Mr. Chairman, one of my biggest concerns is the chain of command, that you have a supervisor with an employee to the payroll clerk, to the county attorney, and it comes to us. Now, once a year, okay, but I would hate to see it every pay period. We're here as county commissioners deciding whether that person or that employee gets the overtime or he doesn't.
Well, that's the idea behind holding the classification, whether exempt or non-exempt. If they're exempt, they're not eligible for overtime. If they're non-exempt, they are.
Well, I understand that.
If it becomes a question of too much overtime, then that's between us and the department head in terms of verifying or validating the need for that much
overtime.
Well,
I can just there again, as a county commissioner, that's a supervisor, the county clerk, the payroll clerk, all of these people, if they bring it to us, okay. But, boy, I would hate to see this happen every time somebody puts in overtime.
We should only have to make that decision once, whether they're exempt or non-exempt. And once that's determined, then it's up to the department.
Well, I was
those job duties change significantly, we're classifying positions, and once that position is classified.
And so I misunderstood, because I was under the impression that if they were non-exempt and they qualified for overtime, but there was a discrepancy, it would wind back on our table.
No, what's going to wind up in our table is after the supervisors review their employees, make their recommendations to us, whether they feel that employee ought to be exempt or non-exempt, the ultimate decision comes with us in terms of yay or nay. And as Commissioner Noble noted, if there's some question about individuals in that then we'll just have to have that discussion with the supervisor prior to making our
decision. And that's my question, and my concern is the number of times we have that discussion.
No, that's just one time setting up that position, unless the position
changes significantly, that would warrant a reconsideration.
So this isn't going to happen with a non-certified person? I don't mean non-certified.
An exempt person?
Non-exempt person.
Non-exempt's eligible for overtime.
Absolutely.
Yes. Right.
And so I may be a little confused here.
We're not approving their overtime.
No.
We're just approving that
their position to get overtime. Oh, okay.
And so I hope this is a one-time deal.
One-time deal.
And it's a fair
Very
point.
Good.
And again, unless those job duties change significantly, once that classification is made, then that's it.
Okay.
But I do think, it's incumbent to write herd on the number of the hours of overtime that employees are claiming, and are they legitimate or not. If they're working those hours, absolutely. But if they're excessive and not justifiable, then that's another discussion.
Right.
But that's the supervisor's position.
Exactly.
Right.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Carrie, you had a question or a comment?
Well, if I can just, historically, it was just kind of understood which positions were exempt and non-exempt.
It was never a formal designation.
Right, and that's all we're doing now to be compliant with FSL.
FLSA.
Well, we do need our supervisors to really pay some attention to whether or not the overtime is really legitimate. Is it not legitimate? If it's legitimate and if it reaches so many hours, then they need to hire another employee and save some money.
Or reduce the number of overtime.
Or reduce the hours one way or another.
If they're not legitimate, absolutely.
Right.
That's the responsibility falls on the supervisor at that point.
So, Mr. Chairman, so I have a question, Matt. The time and a half is based on an hourly breakdown of a salaried employee's time, his salary. So does that include any benefits in that package? In other words, because the benefits, quite frankly, are a significant part of what folks make here in the county. So if we're looking time and a half, is that just on his paycheck, or does that include based on the whole thing? In other words, if you've got, to make it easy for me to understand, if you're working and your salary's $10, but your benefit's another $5, so now my question is the time and a half based on $10 or $15?
Strictly on salary.
Strict down salary.
Now, there could be, with pension, right?
Like, yeah.
With retirement, if you have that increased salary, then yes, it will.
Yes.
It will.
Because your pension is determined on your three highest years of earning. So if you're making more, your pension is going to go up.
Yes.
But on every overtime line item, retirement is calculated and paid on that too.
Right. So I have a question that came up. In terms of monitoring overtime, we the commissioners don't have any.
If you want access to payroll, I will bring it and you can look at it.
Well, I was going to suggest something simpler. In terms of payroll, when we approve it, can we just have overtime for that pay period or that department?
Yes.
As we're set up right now, our software will not sort that out. Eventually, you'll have.
Well, how do we do it without coming in and just looking at payroll? What's an easier way for us to monitor that?
There isn't one right now. The thing I gave you in your packet on the payroll has a line item for overtime. But it's all overtime together. Our software will not sort out overtime by department at this time. Once we go to ADP, then there'll be reports for every department that you can look at. But at the moment, there's not a mechanism to do that.
But each department head has that information.
They have it on a piece of paper, but not compiled in.
You mean just written as a hand note on a piece of paper?
Yes.
And that's how it comes to you?
Yes.
Didn't realize that.
Well, that could Mr. Chairman, I think that needs to be changed a little bit.
Jerry's working on that.
No, I understand that, but you know what? From a standpoint of me sitting here, it would appear to me that the department heads, if they are going to be the responsible person for seeing that the overtime, whatever it is there, then they need to be able to scatter that workload out to where we don't see $300,000 worth of overtime, however that has to be. And Joel was right. If it may be such a thing as somebody, hey, we can hire another guy a heck of a lot cheaper than we can pay 10 people overtime to fill that position or to help fill
it. I guess my question, Carrie, if they document that to give to you, why can't they document it to give to us? The same thing. And I'm thinking, like, we don't have that many department heads that we would be that concerned about. Road and bridge, maintenance, landfill, you know, those are a few I think of that I would be interested to just look at how much overtime they're paying and why. So when they're sitting on this table, we could say, well, what happened this month that required this much additional overtime? So we can address that if we need to.
Eventually, I can get those reports for you, but right now I don't have a way to break the overtime out by department.
Don't they turn it into you by department?
On a piece of paper.
So can you copy that?
I can bring payroll every month for you to see. And I did.
And it would show up on that by department?
No. It'll show up on the piece of paper. But there's no mechanism in our software to show overtimes separated.
Excuse me, I think what Joel's asking, correct me, is that when those pieces of paper show up for you from each department head, mm-hmm. just whoop out five more copies of that.
It's like this thick. All payroll that comes to me from the county.
No, we're
the
just...
timesheets are this
we're just
thick.
Talking
they're
about
not breaking out individual overtime
pile.
It's all payroll in a lump sum. This employee had 48 hours... but that's part of the overall department.
Oh, gotcha.
They're not breaking it down for
her
to see.
Shouldn't it be?
Well, it's never been.
Well, you're going to be able to do that once you get ADP.
Yes.
And once ADP's online, then we will see which department's using which overtime for which situation.
In the meantime, how long are we talking about?
It's been since forever. We've been going this way, so what's your
timeline?
We're
hoping to go live with ADP by... the end of October. We've had some setbacks, so we're going to have to still taking it slowly. It's a huge process of getting everything uploaded and converted so that we can...
I understand that, but what I'm having issues with is why if a department head sends overtime, he has to know who he or she is and it's filed for that overtime.
They approve every timesheet that comes to me. And they can look at it and see which person has worked the overtime. But as far as a report that prints out that says what they are for department, we don't have that.
But could we make a requirement for the department heads as they do their time just to report to us how much overtime their department had for this month?
You could.
I don't want to sound complacent, but is this really necessary when ADP will be online by the first of the year?
Yeah, and that's a good point.
It's been going this way for since the beginning of time.
Well,
let's get to the first year, and then you've got it.
Because right now you'd have to look at each individual.
Without making them reinvent the wheel and then do it again when ADP is implemented.
I'll be happy to go get payroll for last month if you want to see it and see what form it's in.
But again, you'd have to look at each individual timesheet to
absolutely.
Know which employee
was
over 40 hours.
Yeah, and that goes back to my original thing. I don't want to get involved in that. Now, if you give me a street and says that here in the county, the landfill had 75 hours of overtime, then I can call Billy and I can say, Billy, what's going on? And he can tell me that all of a sudden everybody from Hoback Ranch has brought in all of their stuff.
That's exactly what I was trying to get to.
But we'll get to that. I think everybody's on the same page, what they want. It just needs to be simplified, and right now I don't think we can. So, brings up another question. If ADP, is there a section of ADP, and please don't laugh, that HR can be fitted into?
Absolutely.
Okay. I'm sorry. That was for you, kind of.
Thank you, Commissioner.
But it's one of those things that every time, whether we turn around the corner, it comes up, and we have to solve this problem somewhere, and hopefully this will help us in some way solve this problem and take the workload off of the people and put it someplace else, and we can be moving forward with the county, because we've a lot of things going on.
Well, I think we are moving forward. It's like Commissioner Noble said, you know, that there is a short time frame in between. We know this is going to get resolved. It's been a concern, but I don't think a stopgap measure is going to make much difference before we get the chance to implement ADP, and then we can go back and revisit and get that information that we're looking for.
Remind me what ADP stands for.
That's that outfit that's going to do the timing. I'm not sure what the language is, but that's the one that is going to be contracted to do the payroll.
They're not contracted to do payroll. We still do payroll. They are software that
facilitates us
to get
the
reports that we need to
help you with this problem.
Right now, payroll is in YCATS and two or three different spreadsheets.
Okay.
Adding, distracting, and something to do with psychrometer. So that's the only. I'm sorry.
It's protocol.
It's protocol. Yeah.
So if the commission is comfortable with, we talked about August 20th.
Yes. We can get an email out to the department heads and the list of their employees and have them let us know exempt and non-exempt.
Okay.
And then bring that list back as recommended by the department heads at the next commission meeting.
And I'll work with the department heads if they have any questions in terms of the classifications, but that's kind of what we were thinking at this point, if you gentlemen are okay with that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for your work.
No problem.
I don't know when you'd have time for lawyering.
Say again.
When do you have time to be a lawyer?
I still have some time.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks, Matt.
Yep. Would you be the liaison for HR?
No.
Okay. We're right on schedule, I guess. Shaz, if you'd like to come forward and enlighten us.
Absolutely. Today I'm talking radio. You guys all excited?
Yeah.
Mike Phillips in on the supposed fire at New Ford Lake. It was on Bob Rule's radio.
There was a fire at New Ford Lake.
Was it really?
Yeah.
There was.
Okay. I'll the verse for a sec. So, last Saturday, about 1 o'clock, somewhere in that ballpark, we got a call for a report of a wildland fire in the timber right behind New Ford Lake at the Boy Scout camp. And we responded. We sent 4 of our fire apparatus and coordinated our response with the U.S. Forest Service. They sent one of their trucks out of the Pinedale Field office, and then eventually one of their trucks out of the Jackson office made it down as well. And all of us kind of, you know, held hands around that thing and sprayed a whole lot of water and put it out. But we held it at about 1.1 acres. There was some significant fire activity then there. And I was, you know, as many rainstorms as we've had and as much moisture as we've been having in the afternoons. I mean, it's not a tremendous amount, but I thought it was enough to kind of tamp down the fire activity. I was a little taken aback that I seen the fire activity in there that I did. So I was glad that we had a quick response and a good coordinated effort there from everybody's parts, and we were able to get a hold of that thing and get that knocked down and keep it from going. You know,
good. Thank you. Appreciate the update.
And it was all on Forest Service. It was just, you know, we're there helping them out, and it was the Forest Service. Really, we've been exceptionally busy. We've been our firefighters are well, we're responding. It's been averaging about 2 calls a day, and it just doesn't seem to be slowing down. There've been some significant, very serious calls, and there's been a lot of mundane calls as well. But it's still
calls a call.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And the guys are still dropping, you know, what they're doing at work or with the family, and coming to the station and going to every incident, and we're doing great. And I'm very, very pleased with where we're standing. We've got a great, strong organization, dedicated volunteers, and they just couldn't be more proud of the work they're doing. But, they're very, very busy, I can tell you that for sure.
Well, I'm a little bummed we couldn't be there at your graduation ceremony.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We didn't have a choice.
Yeah, well, I understand. It was, you know, your budget night that night. I understand. But we scheduled the graduation ceremony like 7 months in advance, and it just... I didn't think about it when we scheduled it, but yeah, I mean, we should have known that when your budget hearing was, and next year we'll be better prepared to avoid that conflict.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, I appreciate that. Great graduation ceremony, though. We're very pleased to graduate as many new recruits as we did. So. All right, so I've got a lot on the agenda here today. You guys mind if I dig in and kind of get us all briefed up? First thing, remember 2 weeks ago I came and met with the Harris representatives. We had the head people in charge from Harris come fly out and make a presentation to the commissioners and try to get everything back on track. I was very much, I was very pleased with Harris's presentation, and they've made a good faith effort to bridge the gap that we've had, and I thought it was a good stroke on their part to present a zero cost change order. There was a couple of minor issues in that change order that were excluded. We've since corrected that. I've got the change order with me. If you're comfortable signing it, I'll just leave it with Carrie and have that signed, sure. And get it back with me, and just,
or you can just give it to me, Shad.
That works. I apologize, I didn't get that ready for you to sign.
Or give it to Carrie. Give it to Carrie. I don't want to slow you up.
I looked at it. I just seen the signature page, and now I can't find it, of course. That's the attachment.
She'll find it while you continue.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. All right. So anyhow, I was very pleased with that. We're making good progress with Harris, and things are really beginning to progress and get back on track with where it would be. Thank you very much for that, Mr. Noble. That was beyond my capacity to find that, apparently. All right. The other thing, we've got some good news that came from the BLM. I just got on the phone with Douglas Lynn, the acting field manager from the BLM field office. He said that all the required supporting documentation that was necessary for the environmental assessment has been submitted and is in their office. He said that he's actually got the decision sitting on his desk today. There's a matter of some internal record keeping and filing and so on that needs to occur, but he expects to issue final decision on Friday this week for the requested Lumen radio site. And so on Friday, we should have the BLM paperwork that we need to move forward with the new radio site.
So, Shad, does that mean we've got to be able to actually date something to get started?
Yes, sir.
On that?
Yes, sir. Yeah, we've done all the archaeological surveys and everything else that needs to be done to move forward with that project. Once we have the final decision in hand, then we can get on track with running power lines and pouring foundations and doing everything that needs to be done. And that's actually a very impressive time frame to get the EA done. I'd like to just say kudos to the BLM and to everybody that worked together. We had weekly coordination meetings, and Commissioner Noble and myself and Dave Smith and the field personnel from the BLM have been working diligently for several months now to get to this point in a very strong partnership with everybody to get to where they're ready to issue that decision. So I'm very much appreciative of what they've done. So once we have that in hand, then we can move forward with digging ground and doing what we need to do to get the new radio tower out there stood up and moving forward. So that's kind of what my reason for being here today is I'd like to get everything lined up to begin that work as soon as possible and take advantage of the weather window that we have in front of us. So that being said, we've been in close coordination with Union, cellular phone company, to share power with them. The way it works is Rocky Mountain Power has a power corridor that follows Highway 191, but then Union has ran their own private power off of that main power that runs along the highway that goes to one of their sites back up in there a couple of miles. As a cost savings measure, rather than running new power to this radio set that we're talking about, we've been working closely with the Union representatives to see if we can just tap into their existing line and just run it up the two-track road. And I can't remember the exact length, but about 400 or 500 feet of power line needs to be run instead of, you know, 2 miles or whatever it worked out to be.
The other factor to that was there was no way we was going to meet those timelines with the EAs and all them assessments to make that long.
Yeah.
This got us past all that.
Yep. Yeah, so Union's been very supportive and working closely with Commissioner Noble to put together everything they need to move forward with that. I've got a draft power sharing agreement with Union. I've shared this with Matt Gaffney. There's a couple of issues that still need to be worked out there. Matt's working with the attorney from Union to work out those outstanding details. The way I understand from speaking with Rocky Mountain Power is that Union can't buy power from Rocky Mountain Power and then sell it back to us. So we can't purchase power from Union. They're not a utility company. But what we can do is share in the cost of maintenance of keeping that line, you know, with what we need for everybody to, you know, for Union and Sullivan County to benefit from. So that's one of the things we're trying to work out is what's an appropriate charge for that maintenance fee, and we're working through that process right now. And I expect to have something shortly to be ready for signature. What I'd like to request from the commissioners and with Matt Gaffney's guidance is once Matt's happy with the terms of the agreement, would the board allow Commissioner Burnett to sign that agreement with Union to allow us to move forward, or do I need to come back and present that agreement formally, or how would you like to best proceed with the best way to move forward with that?
Matt, are you comfortable with that?
You know, sir, just talked to Union's corporate counsel this morning. They're good with all my changes. We're just waiting on the price. So I think we're so close on the agreement. So I am very comfortable with that because they have agreed to the modifications I asked for in that agreement.
So we would need a motion by the commission allowing me to sign the agreement once it's been finalized?
The price has been, the price for the power has been finalized. That's the only outstanding issue to address.
Okay.
So I'll make that motion if you're ready.
Yeah.
Second.
There you go. Moved and second. Any discussion?
Well, I'm just curious about the price. Is there a ballpark that we're looking at?
Yeah.
Kind of.
So what we've been trying to do is figure out what are we paying for power at the other radio sites, and it's kind of like finding a needle in the haystack. But I've had ML working with the county clerk's office trying to find exactly which power meter we're paying power and what that actual cost is. We've been able to find some average data, and it looks like for our Hogsback radio tower, our average monthly bill is $55 a month. For our Kismet radio tower, our average power bill there is $73 a month. So that would be my recommendation to try to find something in line with what we're paying for power at the other sites. But I don't know. I mean, that's a power bill. That's not the same as a maintenance agreement. And I'd imagine that, you know, due to the length of the runner, there's any number of variables that could be included in this, and I imagine there's going to be some negotiation necessary to get to that point. So, but ballpark numbers, that's what I would expect.
But we're still got to plow it in.
Yes, sir.
From there to the what'd you say? Not very far, apparently.
Yeah, help me remember, Dave. How far does the plow line need to be run for the new power?
574 or 8 feet, okay, to the north boundary of Lumen, and then we'll have to do a bore under Lumen, and then daylight excavation for another approximately 100 feet to get to the Union primary line, where we'll cut it and put in the two boxes and do the splice.
Just as a note, Union's been very, very, very accommodating because they use their engineers to help come up with a product, a list of things that we will need for a contractor to put together.
So as far as I'm concerned, whatever number they come up with, if you're comfortable and what Chairman Burnett's comfortable with it, sign it and go on.
I would like to think it'd be somewhere between the $75 and $100 range. More likely.
Unless it's something that's just outrageous. And
yeah, if it's $10,000 a month, we're
yeah.
Back
they're going to make the motion and cap it at, I don't even know what an appropriate number is. If it exceeds $150, then we'll bring it back in front of the commission for discussion.
Well, I don't know that we could probably go with the motion we have, just with the understanding that I have. If it's going to be that excessive, I will not sign the document and come back to the commission.
So, Matt, in my thoughts, if we put a fixed number, because it is an estimated number, but leave some wording in there that can be adjusted in the following budget year, so that if it's low, that we're not leaving Union hanging. Some wording to that effect. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. So if we don't pay them enough the first year, we can bump that number to make it fair for them.
Well, they can always come back to us anytime.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's just a matter of changing the agreement to match the conditions that are found out there.
Yes, sir. I'm just saying that wording's going to have to be in there for them to approve this.
Wouldn't there be a meter of some kind anyway, Chad, going from their line to or not?
I mean, $75, what the heck? That's not a big deal. I'm just curious.
I'll defer to Commissioner Noble.
We can't go off of meters.
No, because they can't sell us.
Without a contract through Rocky Mountain.
Right.
So it has to be worded as a maintenance agreement.
Right. And that's going to be the dollar range.
It's got to be a dollar amount.
Yeah. But if their power that they're paying as a result of this goes up by
$150
a month,
sure.
Exactly.
That's the information they go on.
Yeah.
Exactly. But we can't. If we enter into this defining it as a power sale, then we have to go into another agreement with Rocky Mountain. So it has to be a maintenance agreement.
I got that. Yeah. Understood. Any more discussion? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Motion carries. Let me know.
Thank you very much. Yeah. All right. Now, as we just discussed a little bit, I'll need approval to, once we have the BLM agreement in hand, we'll need to get started right away with running power. So what I've already asked was, I've reached out to Todd Hurd and said, what's going to be necessary? What I'd like the board's approval to do is to have Todd go to bid to run power for the 500 feet and do the under the Lumen Road the power transformers on the wrong side of the Lumen Road, so we're actually going to have to cross the Lumen Road. And there's a couple of ways that we can do that. We'll try to figure out the most cost reasonable way to get across Lumen Road without negatively impacting the traffic that needs to go out there. And I don't know if that's going to need to be an underbore or if I see some nodding their head. Yes.
At the last meeting, Chad, they said that they're not going to let us plow through it. We're going to bore it.
Yeah, it's a bore.
It's a bore.
They've made that guarantee of the easement update that they shut down the plow. And the biggest reason is they didn't want passage over Lumen blocked in case there was some sort of an emergency. Gotcha. If equipment broke or something went wrong, they just didn't want to see that corridor blocked.
Okay. But what I'm going to need is guidance from the commission to allow us to go to bid to run that power, including the boring underneath the road and then running the 500 feet of power. And then furthermore, because of the existing power that Union uses, we're going to be increasing that power. We're going to need to change the transformers that feeds the line to Union, and so we'll need to change the electricity a little bit, and we're going to need to hire an electrical contractor to connect the power and then change the transformers to adequately supply both Union and Sullivan County to provide power for this new site. So I'm just looking for guidance from the commission.
I'd say go for it, but my question is, where does this come from in the budget?
It's out of the communications line item.
Out of the communications?
Mm-hmm. Is it
the reserve?
It's not part of the Harris.
Yes,
it's
not in the original scope.
Oh, I'm sorry, it's not part of the original scope, but this would be
my thought is this would be part of the build out of the entire system. We knew there'd be unanticipated costs similar to this that would be part of that, that reserve that we've established for the communications.
So you just have to do a transfer from the communications account into the Harris project?
Or use it out of the Harris project, then we'll backfill that one when we get to a budget adjustment.
Yeah, right.
I'm good with it. Move forward, Chad, because winners.
Yeah, go ahead and get the bids out.
We got to have a block of cement poured.
Yeah. Okay, so then with that, I'll give Todd final arrangements to go to bid and get ready to run power and hire an electrical contractor to connect it all. Next, along the same lines, now that we have everything in place for the BLM agreement, next we're going to need to purchase a tower and then a shelter as well for the facility. And as you recall, when Dave Smith was here with us a couple months ago, he presented a ballpark estimate. We fine-tuned those numbers. We've got concrete bid numbers on what a new tower will cost. And then furthermore, I've actually asked Mark Warner with Rocky Mountain Communications to be here today to speak about what a new shelter costs. So to start with, let me go over the tower bid. I have a bid in my hands. This is the same tower company that's built the other towers that we already have in the county. So I'd like to, my recommendation is to use the same company for uniformity and consistency amongst all of our equipment and then the maintenance on that equipment. Furthermore, not only the front page is the tower bid, and the second page was the structural engineering necessary to make sure that all the equipment that we mount to the tower wouldn't overload the tower and that the wind wouldn't blow it over.
That does not include concrete.
Yeah, that's strictly just the tower.
So, is that in there? Is there room for future build on this tower?
A whole bunch of room.
Okay, that's what I wanted to hear. So
we originally spec'd the tower to 220, and the BLM said you can't do that. You can only go to 199. So that's cool. We changed our POD with the BLM to 199. The tower is still designed for 220. We're only building it to 160, so we could easily put another 40 feet on it and hang a whole bunch of stuff if we wanted to.
Okay.
So there's lots of extra capacity.
So, Dave, where does this bid stand with what you projected to us when we talked a couple of months
ago? Right in there. Very, very close.
Okay.
There haven't been any surprises yet. When it comes to towers, we've had some concrete challenges just because of logistics on the mountaintops, but the actual steel and the erection of the towers, we haven't had any surprises there.
So this is erected, not just a truck unloading it off the semi and we got to hire somebody to put it up.
No, that's built.
This is installed.
Yep. With the exception of the concrete.
With the exception of the concrete.
Done by a concrete company.
Well, it does say here it doesn't include the crane for tower installation.
Correct, and they've all been that way. That one is the same as all of the other ones that we've done.
So that, I mean, we still have to, we would...
We provide a crane.
Okay.
Yeah, we're billed for the crane. As well as the concrete.
So they furnish the crane, but we have to get the crane in and out? I don't understand.
No, we pay for the crane, and we are responsible for getting the cranes up and down the mountains. That language is in there because of White Pine and the
it's two options.
Challenges
again. Okay. I don't see the two options.
This is just the lumen towers we're talking. So there's no going up and down the mountains. It's strictly just lumen.
The crane can drive easily to that side.
Shouldn't cost that much there.
Cranes are expensive. Who have you been using in the past?
What's that?
Who have you been using in the past for cranes?
They've been using Reese's.
Okay. Yeah.
So this is a quote. You need a motion to accept the quote from CTCI?
To purchase the tower.
Yes. Now the second page is
the structural analysis to ensure the tower is strong enough to hold the weight of mounting.
That's already been done. we've got the analysis. I sweet talked them into doing that because I told them there was no way we could consider anything
without
that. So that's just the bill for that. But we've got the analysis.
So what we need is a motion to accept the quote for the installation of the tower.
Yes, sir.
So moved.
And the amount of
how much?
Well, I've just got a question here. It says no lights. Does that mean no?
$139,000. That one doesn't need to be lighted. The FAA's rules for towers, anything under 199 feet, or 200 feet rather, doesn't have to be lit. Once you go over that, you have to light them unless you're within a certain proximity of an airport, which that one is not. So there's no lighting.
Well, that may be, but wouldn't it still be? Just know you. Wouldn't it still be a good thing to have a light on top of a 100-and-some-foot tower?
It's the owner's option. If you do choose to light it, you have to comply with all the FAA lighting regs, which is a whole other layer of regulations and stipulations. And if you voluntarily choose to light an unpainted tower, you have to fill out a 4760 form with the FAA. And you send that in, and then they send you back instructions on how they want your tower, how they want you to do it. You also have to fill out that same form if you're within a certain physical distance of any active airspace and airport. In this case, we don't have to do any of that with that tower unless we choose to light it. If we light it, then we do have to go through that process. But if it's 199 feet or less, you do not have to light it if you're not by an airport. So my advice to you guys is don't put a light on it. I understand what you're saying for just common sense safety reasons. It kind of makes sense to have a light on it.
It's about 39.
It's a lot more complicated than that in the eyes of the
I make a motion we accept the bid for the radio tower from Coalition Tower Consultants for the price of $139,275.
Second.
Oh, sorry. I amend that by saying, what's this one for, Jim?
That's just what we've already
This is for the structural analysis also, which is $2,160 from the same company.
So we've got a motion to accept the quote in the amount of $179,275 and then pay their asking price of what we've on the structural analysis of $2,160. Do you have a second?
Second.
Got a motion and a second. Any discussion? If not, I'll signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you very much. All right. Next, I want to talk about shelters, but we're actually going to talk about two different shelters. The tower that we just agreed to purchase is also going to need a shelter, and what a shelter does is it houses all the electronic equipment, all the radio repeaters, and all the electronics that need to support that tower. There's much more complex explanation that Mark can give in a few minutes. But before I invite Mark up, I want to make sure that we understand that there's actually two different shelters that I'm going to request today. As a result of the Roosevelt Fire, when the Roosevelt Fire burned through, it burned over the existing Kismet radio site that we had. I've been in contact with Mark Pape, our insurance company, and discussed the insurance claim that we have. I have that paperwork with me today. But all the paperwork is ready, and the county's actually already received payment from that loss of the shelter. We need to rebuild the Kismet radio site and put up a new tower and put up a new shelter at the Kismet site. So what I'd like to do is have a conversation about putting a new shelter on Kismet to replace what was already burned down. And then also we need to put a second shelter here with this Lumen site to accompany the tower that we just agreed to. So with that, I'd like to request Mark Warner to come up and have a seat with me, and let's have a conversation about shelters. So Mark has provided us a bid I'm sorry. Let me introduce Mark for a second. This is Mark Warner. He's been here a couple of times in the past. Mark is the contract communications company that Harris is working with to do all the actual installation and build out the new Harris system. So Mark's the one that's physically doing all the work. He runs Rocky Mountain Communication System is his business. He's the one that is providing the shelter that's going to go on top of Hogsback. That price is included in the price of the original contract with Harris. The two shelters I'm talking about now are outside of that contract, and the reason why is because the Kismet shelter burned down and the Lumen shelter is a new additional increase to the scope. So Mark has provided us a description of what those shelters will be and a price, and the reason why I asked Mark to be here was to justify, you know, why the shelter is necessary and what we need to provide in those shelters. And so with that, I defer to Mark for a sec to make a presentation. And
all right. Well, essentially, there was some questioning about the design of the shelters and why they are the way they are. And I wrote a description there for Shad about the fairly specialized nature of the shelters with communications equipment and different things about them.
This is the description that he's talking about?
This document is the actual specification of the shelter and description of it. The document that Shad's passing out right now is actually a kind of a little dissertation on why these things are configured the way they are, as opposed to a tough shed that you go by and haul up there. So it's a pretty specialized piece of equipment, and it houses all of the equipment that's at the site, and that's a fairly substantial investment. As we found when Kismet burned, if the shelter isn't pretty robust, then you lose everything that's in it. And that is a big part of the cost of these operations. These are precast concrete with a 5-inch thick roof. They are bullet resistant up to a 30-06, as well as fire resistant. And it's absolutely necessary these things be completely sealed to keep any type of insects and rodents out, because they cause just all kinds of havoc on the equipment on the inside. Additionally, we have a redundant air conditioning system that's in these in case there's a failure of a prime unit, the secondary one picks up automatically. And one of the driving forces in the shelter design is the ability to ground and surge protect everything that's in the shelter. Literally every single piece of metal that's in this structure is tied together with copper wire into a ground system. I mean every single piece of metal, which is a fairly intense undertaking. If you ever once you see one of these, you would understand amount of connections that are involved, and all these connections have to be very low resistance in order to provide the surge protection and lightning resistance that we're looking for. Also, the electrical system has been optimized for that. Also, there is a centralized surge protection system for the AC power. All the breakers are, everything is tied together to try to minimize the amount of damage that can be done when a lightning strike. You can't prevent a lightning strike. You can only try to shunt all that energy off to some place where it doesn't damage your equipment. There's a very specialized set of specifications and instructions for doing that. And as part of meeting that specification, the building has to have a 9-foot inside ceiling height in order to accommodate all of this. So that winds up creating a fairly expensive shelter, and one that's this shelter weighs about 75,000 pounds. It's 12 by 24. So it's a pretty robust piece of engineering. And I would say that I've been involved in a lot of projects, hundreds over the past 40 years, and every place where the shelters were, I'm not going to say cheap enough, I'll say they were compromised. There's been a lot of pain attached to that follow-on, because if you have another fire, or if someone actually decides to do target practice, the net result is now we have to dismantle the entire site, put another shelter in. Huge, huge undertaking. So, and these are very typical shelters that you find in public safety grade operations. So there's nothing unusual in that respect. But for people that haven't participated in a lot of these projects as in the past, the price could seem pretty shocking. So we did want to take the opportunity to visit about why they cost what they do.
In, Mr. Chairman, in what way do they differ? Why the difference in price of that 84 is 97?
It's actually the cost to get that shelter up on Kismet.
Oh, okay.
Lumen is a short putt.
Right, got it.
Getting it up there is a...
The next question is for Shad. On Kismet, how much did we get out of insurance?
We're going to use ready. All right. I have a letter this morning from Mark Pape describing the insurance claim. I don't have the number in front of me there, but basically the insurance claim was for $140,000, and that's what we will receive from the insurance company. We've actually already received 120-ish. 21 dozen of that claim. The remainder holdback is once we've proven that we've expended the money, then they pay the remainder of that holdback. I feel it's appropriate to move forward with the shelter as described, and I think that the insurance claim helps kind of cover the some of that cost. My request to the board today would be that rather than award the bid that you have in front of you from Mark, I haven't had an opportunity to compare this with other costs, and I don't feel ready to make recommendation to the board to award this until I've had that opportunity. But what I would like to do is take advantage of the fact that Mark was here. He's here on doing work for the build out, and that's the reason why I asked him to be here, and I wanted him to come present to the commission to explain the need for the shelter and the cost associated with it. I'd like to be able to compare the cost with Mark's quote, and then make recommendations to the board, and then allow Commissioner Burnett to sign a quote at such time as we feel that we're making the best decision, for the build out of the system in the most cost-effective manner. But in order to do that, I need a little additional time to do a cost comparison and explore other potential alternatives and then make sure that this is the best decision in front of us. So, I apologize for the for bringing Mark here and then not asking you to approve what he's presenting to you, but I just don't feel comfortable making the recommendation that I think this is the best option, just because I don't know. I haven't had the opportunity to compare his option to alternative or compare some options.
So, do you think you'll have this before you need to move on this before our next meeting?
Yes, sir.
Okay, the other question. If this system would have been in place at Kismet, do you feel it would have protected the equipment from the fire?
Putting me on the spot there.
I said, do you feel? I don't think there's no proof on that deal, but 6-4-inch concrete wall, you would think that it would withstand lot of heat.
There's a comparable building that's on Kismet that's used by, is it PBS or who's the
it's
other?
Verizon.
Verizon. That withstood very well to the right adjacent to our building.
There were a couple other factors with the airdrop and stuff, but if I could step in, the answer would be yes. Had we had a concrete roof on our concrete building, we would have replaced the antennas and the feed lines, and we would have been able to turn it back on.
To answer your direct question, yes, I feel that this building would have withstood the onslaught from the Kismet fire better than the existing building.
And this was one of these buildings that was up
No, the building that we had up there originally was not one of these buildings that Mark's proposing. What we had was, I don't want to underrate it, a very small cinder block building with a wood roof.
Right, no, I'm talking about the one that withstood.
Oh, yeah, it's not the same building, but it's in the same vein.
Very similar.
Yeah, it's a exterior aggregate concrete building that's up there that's very similar to what he's proposing here.
The term industry standard is what we should be using because that's what these buildings are. They're industry standard for remote communications facilities.
Does the money in the budget cover this cost?
This would be out of the communications reserve.
Right.
So
there's enough there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So what I would recommend is the board approve up to the amount that's on the quote. Allow me a little time to sharpen my pencil a little bit to make sure that we have a comparison to compare against, and then make recommendation on what's the most economic and reasonable way to move forward, and then if we're in agreement, then we can award the best decision at that time based on the quotes that are available.
Are you talking about the quotations on the shelter costs that Mark's presenting?
Yes, I would
recommend a motion to approve it up to that amount.
Yes, sir.
So move.
Well,
you read
them? Yeah.
I make a motion we approve Mark's shelter cost. What's the name of the company?
I don't want to award the bid.
No.
Approve
I
the
make
dollar
a motion
amount.
We approve the dollar amount of the shelter for Kismet and Lumen. Kismet not to exceed $196,936, sorry. And Lumen shelter not to exceed $184,911.
So we're not approving a bid, we're just approving the go-ahead with a project not to exceed that amount. Do we have a second?
Second.
Any discussion?
Correct. I was wondering when, Chad, when we get these others, I'd be curious, could I get an email on with the information just so I can compare here also? Thank you.
So we're looking at this or less? Any other comments or questions?
This or less, that's the best decision for the bill out of the system.
Sure, yeah. But with these...
Yeah, not to exceed.
Not to exceed. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. Mark, thanks for coming.
Yes,
thanks for
being thank you very much.
Okay, I believe that is all I have. I just have my board wasn't sure I didn't forget anything.
I can come back this afternoon.
I think that's all right.
We'll still be here.
Thank you very much for your time and support of this project. Oh, I did want to mention I've had several meetings with the sheriff and the undersheriff, and we're all in concurrence as to what we presented today. The sheriff wasn't able to be here, and the undersheriff wasn't able to be here with him today.
Good deal.
Yeah.
Thanks, Chad.
Do you want me to bring lunch?
It's just quite here to go to lunch.
Well, the lunch is coming to us.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, we're not. I've got this group figured out. We can't get through by noon. For we'll go ahead and handle a few part of this. I mean, we can still do the. We got public comments. These guys have been waiting. We can do that. The rest of it, we can have lunch and then do during lunch.
Okay. So wait.
Yeah. We're 2 months in reports. I know you guys have been waiting for a while, but. We'll go ahead and proceed with public comments if you have something for us.
Yeah.
Yeah, come on up. Wendy, you want to come up?
So I'm going to give you guys a quick update. Mainly it's on the merger. I met with Don Walker and Patty Rossi this morning, and actually the Subtle Center Board's meeting with department heads today. They're going to meet with Nick Healy on Monday the 12th, and we have a tentative meeting, combined meeting with our board and their board for the morning of the 19th. And so I just want to let you guys know that we're moving ahead. And so that's the big news I have today. As far as the ball fields, obviously we're on hold until Monday the 12th, and then as you guys probably already aware of that. And the only other question I had is, we talked about your commissioner morning meeting.
Yes.
And I was waiting for an invite, but maybe I shouldn't.
We didn't do it this month.
Oh, you didn't? Okay.
We're going to do it next month, and we will add the healthcare district to that invite list.
Okay.
It'll be next.
No worries. I just want to make sure I didn't miss it.
So I'd like to advise that when we don't do it, we need to send out a letter saying that we're not. Does that make sense? Because
yeah.
I got Doug with the BLM texted me last night saying, are we meeting or not?
So well, let's discuss that. Do you guys want to start and go back to meeting every month? Do you want to make it simple? What do you want to do? We had that.
I'm fine with once a month is great. But I just, what my point here is, if we're not going to meet, we need to let them know.
So do you guys want to meet once a month? You feel the need to go back to doing that?
To have breakfast meeting once a month?
Yeah.
I would like to do that.
I think that's necessary.
Well, we'll go back to just making a regular breakfast meeting once a month at the first meeting of the month.
It doesn't matter to me if it's the first or second, but first is easier to remember.
Yep, the first is easier.
Yeah,
first meeting of the month.
Yeah.
So we'll just do that. We'll put you on the list.
That's good. Thank you.
We didn't meet today.
Okay. All right. Any questions I can answer from you guys?
How's recruiting?
We got turned down on Dr. Paulson. I talked to another physician yesterday. So we're just going to keep moving ahead. We still have activity. We still have people interested. So we'll find that right person. It'll just take a little time. The good news is, I mean, the pressure's off for us because we're back to 6 providers. So we're back to the same number of providers, you know, before Capman left. And so our call schedule, everything is on track. Brad Lindstrom, our new PA, is working out really well. And so, yeah. I want us to take our time and really make a good selection. So
with your upcoming meeting, with the Nick Healy, is that something that's going to be, you'll have some determination after that in terms of moving forward if you've worked out?
I'm hoping. Yeah, I'm hoping that we got a memo from Nick kind of giving us some options. They're going to meet. Obviously, there's one option that I like better than the others, but hopefully we'll have some answers. I want some answers on the 19th, you know what I mean? Some direction and some timelines. And so that's my goal anyways.
So the district is still looking at moving forward with an application to the USDA this fall?
And we've spoken with Lorraine Werner, and she's excited about a merger.
I had a phone call with her last week. Everything is good with her. We just got to get going. I guess the way I'm looking at it is I need the merger decision and I need the ball field decision. Then we can start moving ahead with the financial projections and the architectural work. And so I'm hoping that we have a couple answers here pretty shortly on those two items, and we can get moving.
Well, it sounds like the town's going to have a decision for you after Monday. That's when they were supposed
to hear from
their
RFP.
So I guess you'll plan on going to that meeting?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we'll be there.
We're on their schedule.
And that's Monday's a busy day.
Yeah.
Do you have a feel for what they're going to decide? I mean, obviously you've talked to some of those folks at the time.
I think the Sobel Center is very positive, and they're moving ahead. I think today is a good example that they are actually talking to their department heads about the merger. So I think that's a good sign.
Well, I'm talking about the town.
Oh, the ball fields. Oh,
yeah.
I think it's going to work out. I'm optimistic. I think the school board's cooperating with the donation of the land. You know, obviously, you know, we're going to have to get together after that and kind of figure out what that cost is going to be to move the ball fields. That's going to be the big issue, is how much is it going to cost to move the ball fields. And so I guess we'll wait and see, but I'm optimistic. I think it's going to work out. How about you?
You know, I'm just I'm a little bit confused in terms of, you know, the price being set on how much it costs to move the ball fields. I think the question, quite simply, was you're willing to sell the ball fields and how much do you want for them? If you're going to sell the ball fields, then you within your asking price, you know what it's going to take, and you're going to have to pay for the moving. But are you saying that you're going to negotiate a selling price and then have to negotiate with whomever to move them? That's
It's a little backwards.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't make sense.
No, I would think if you're going to sell it, this is your asking price. $2 million, $3 million, whatever it is, and you guys agree to sell, and then they have to take care of it.
Right.
But it seems confusing to me to get
an asking price on the ball fields with a contingency that, by the way, we got to make sure that you pay for the moving, and by the way, we want to make sure that these fields are as good or better than what we had before. I'm not understanding that process. Yeah.
The way I'm looking at it is they had committed $1 million towards CAW early on, and I want this to be a cash neutral proposition for the district. In other words, if they want to use that $1 million towards moving the ball fields, we keep that cost under the million, then it's a cash neutral proposition for us. I guess I don't want us to be spending money out of pocket for the ball fields, but that's my personal opinion.
Well, but then when you get into the cost of moving the ball fields, what if there's cost overruns,
right,
or something comes up? I would think you just agree on the selling price of
right
what you want to buy the land for.
Right.
But I'm not sure I understand.
You would logically look at what it would cost to replace the existing infrastructure to that particular whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to develop a new ball field that's going to have three times as much infrastructure, that's on them,
mm-hmm,
not yeah on the district to pay for it.
Right.
What's a fair way to look at it.
What's your interpretation?
My interpretation is they've got the school that's interested in helping them move, possibly. So that would be a number that would come out of their sale number, possibly. That's mm-hmm why they're not giving you a legitimate number yet. And then they've got to also look at the access to that property. The ball field may not cost whatever, $1 million to move, mm-hmm, but now they have no access to them. So they've got to approach that too as a town. Do they need to build a half a mile of road to get to them and infrastructure to get to them? So there's construction costs incorporated in getting to that new site. And they're trying to legitimately figure out how to disperse those as best they can, whether the school helps out or not, is what they're trying to do. And this approach they're taking is, I'm sure, in every effort trying to get to that.
So they should have a decision based on their RFP of what that is going to take. And basically, well, I guess I'm asking this. Let's say their RFP determines it's going to cost them $2 million to move the ball field.
Mm-hmm.
You're not really paying for them to move the ball field. You're just paying that in their asking price. Or is it going to be, this is the asking price with the guarantee? See, that's what I don't understand,
yeah,
Tom.
Yeah. That's all up in here, I think. I don't think we know that yet.
You know, that, I mean, I can understand what you're saying in terms of construction cost and moving it, but is that included in the price? You know, sign on the dotted line, we got a deal, selling it for X amount of dollars, or are we going to sell it for X amount of dollars plus the moving cost, which can go up or down? But that's what I don't understand. Do you?
I feel I do, yeah.
Okay, then help me.
So, if it's going to cost whatever, $2 million to move them, they're trying to decide whether they're going to take $1 million out of their own coffers, or take the $1 million that they've committed, or is the school going to give them or financially help them out? And I'm sure they're trying to come to a lowest number possible.
That I understand. What I don't understand is, if you come up with that number and you run into an overrun because of whatever reason, does that number still stand? Or is it going to be, I mean, is it going to be based on a completed project, the final cost? That's what I'm asking help with understanding. I understand mm-hmm what they're trying to do in shifting the cost and the school helping out and that kind of thing. But I guess we'll have to wait till Monday night.
Yeah.
There's two questions that I'm having trouble figuring out. Perhaps all of you can help me. The folks behind the ball field thing would like to be able to wake up tomorrow morning and move to their new ball fields. That's not going to happen because that's going to take time. Time is of the essence with construction companies, because you've got construction now that's in full bore someplace. And as the year progresses, it gets busier and busier trying to complete projects that they've got going before winter hits. The reverse happens in the spring of the year. As soon as they can break ground someplace, these companies are going hell-bent for leather. So, as I understand it, it takes special stuff if you would, to build these ball fields, and when is that going to happen? So as this thing continues on, we're going to get into the time warp for winter, and then when spring gets here, everybody's going to be hollering, we got to get it done, and we're not going to, or I say we, they, and they're not going to get it done. So if it doesn't happen, and let's go Tuesday morning, let's get started, I don't see it happening this fall, just because of the, you're not going to find the people to do it, the construction companies to do it. They got to get there collectively together.
Well, I mean,
and so, okay, and so that's going to put these folks in a big bind, because they're not going to turn those ball fields loose until they know that these down here are ready to go.
I agree with you. I understand that. And that's why I ask what the contingencies might be. Are you going to sell the land or not? Is it going to be contingent upon these other things? Because if those are listed contingencies, you may not get this land until 2 years from now if they don't get the ball fields moved.
Yeah.
My impression was Monday night that they would be giving us a number, and that the million they had committed would come off that number, and we would be responsible for the remainder. That was my understanding.
That would be simple. It's just a matter of this is how much we're asking.
Right.
I have a little bit of problem with, I guess the word would be sacrifice. What's more important? We finally have got organizations all coming together. Finally. They're all at the table. And I said that we could do this overnight many, many times, and I finally realized, it's not true. just couldn't happen. But we're really, really close. And now it's baseball fields?
Yeah.
That's the part I'm struggling.
Can't go a week without playing baseball.
Well, and that's the part. And I may be the expert on this commission about baseball, because I played it for 30 years here, and I'm just struggling. Somebody's going to have to sacrifice somewhere to get our critical access hospital, all of the things that you guys want to put together, and it's being held up by a game. And that was my lifestyle. But
one comment, Mr. Chairman. If the land is donated and you don't have to buy it, for the life of me, I cannot figure out how in the heck you could spend $1 million to $3 million putting together a baseball field. It just blows my mind.
Well, you're absolutely correct too, because we have to make it equal to what they have. I don't see a responsibility for us to pay for making it or better.
Don't either.
Right.
Not at all.
Well, good luck on Monday night.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. We will.
And we'll see what happens with the RFP and what they present you with. We don't know. It may be simple. This is how much it's going to cost. This is what we want. But
I do think that that we or they will be coming back to you guys for a little help on the construction side of it, on as far as moving dirt, those kinds of things.
Well, I've put that out for bid. I'm sorry. I couldn't let that go.
I agree.
But we're trying to get it all done for the betterment of the people of Sublette County.
This gets more complicated.
How many sacrifices you want to make?
Yeah.
This gets more complicated. This is the selling price. These are the contingencies. By the way, we're going to include the county in the contingencies of
triple price.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll go to that meeting.
I was going to suggest that maybe one or two of you come to that meeting. And I think we should ask Clay to come.
Yeah, we'll ask Clay to come.
Commissioner Vicker, can you go to that meeting?
I can go to that meeting.
Thank you. Donna?
Sure.
Be interesting. Yeah. Okay. Right. Thanks, guys.
I think that's all we got.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good luck.
I'm in your dugout.
All right. That's good to know.
Okay, so we're going to get the accounts payable and all done, permits, we'll eat lunch, and then we'll finish up with the rest of our business before we start up at 1 o'clock. Need a motion to approve the accounts payable as audited. approve for payment?
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Second. Thank you. We have a motion and a second to approve the accounts payable. Any discussion? Questions? If not, I'll signify by saying aye.
Aye.
You need bread? Nope, good. All right, I need a motion to approve the payroll from July 30th in the amount of $1,032,541.48.
So moved. Second.
Moved by Commissioner Vickery, second by Commissioner Noble. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Okay. I just want to make sure. Any opposed? Motion carries. Next thing, I need a motion to approve a beer permit for the Boulder Bar for the ride for Reed Boone Snide Corps on 8-3 at the rodeo grounds.
So moved.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Janice doesn't have any abatements.
Okay. I need a motion to approve the bond for Roger Weber as treasurer of Shelter Park Improvement District.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. We will sign this, and then we will have lunch brought in and continue on our merry way. You have heartburn before we eat Mexican?
Is there a name?
I think there's just
one. There's a question.
Yes.
Why were we giving out car wash?
I would be at opposition.
It's okay. I don't mind.
Stephanie Lund. That's got to be something
to do with nursing.
The nursing, the.
My decision. Reimburse. I guess Gary can answer.
Oh,
yeah.
Not our decision either.
Yeah.
Not ours either.
I'm going to ask
her. I had no idea what
you
were.
You said just the one sheet on
it. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, I was just checking. That's all I did.
I hope you like Mexican. If not, you can fast too much.
Is that where we're headed?
No, they've headed to us.
Oh, they are?
Yeah, we don't have time for lunch today.
Well, I saw that. I didn't know.
I think it's just one.
We're going to have to make arrangements for this agenda.
Carrie?
So, Doug,
reimburse car wash gift?
So, Doug, you think I need to bite my tongue?
Who was it?
Stephanie.
But why do you say that?
I can pull it.
I think you were poking fun at me and Mom.
No, not at all. Well, how come every time we want to save money at the county, we get somebody throws that we need to give every contractor a benefit of a doubt?
Okay.
So I was just throwing it back the other way. I'm all in favor of it.
Okay. Well, because. Every contractor has been footing the bills for road and bridge construction equipment, and it's just like, they do.
No.
Yeah, they pay their taxes just like
sure they do. But they're a very, very small group of people compared to the entire county. But I'm all in favor of doing everyone by bid. And you're going to see, Doug. You're going to see how bad this, and I'll tell you and I don't want to speak bad about the dead, but Rod Bennett made millions of dollars on this county. And I'll tell you what, and it was all about cost overruns, it was all about this,
well,
it was
I
all
agree
about
with the
that.
Cost overrun thing. They don't bring cost overrun to me, Mac, because you factor it in and they fix cost overrun, it's on you.
We'll find out about this when we do it. And I think it's a great idea. I really do.
Well, how do you know what something can cost? I don't say we're not going to tie it into this deal with the bidding process, but at least you have a feel for it.
Well,
and you put it out there.
Yeah.
You put it out there.
It's just like anything else. Give them an opportunity and let's see what happens.
I did.